All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. I'm Chris Burnett, and tonight I am happy to have on the line to join us Javier Cethnas. Javier Cethnas is a libertarian socialist, educator, and rights advocate. His new book, published by AK Press, Imperiled Life, Revolution Against Climate Catastrophe, is the fourth installment in the Anarchist Intervention Series of the Institute for Anarchist Studies and AK Press. He has worked as a human rights observer in southeastern Mexico, and his writings on climate change, Palestine, and imperialism have appeared in Countercurrents, MR Zine, Dissident Voice, The Electronic Intifada, Climate and Capitalism, and Perspectives on Anarchist Theory. He maintains the blog Notes Toward an International Libertarian Eco-Socialism at intlibecosoc.wordpress.com. That's kind of a mouthful, but I'm going to repeat it again. That's intlibecosoc.wordpress.com. Javier, welcome to Indie Media On Air. It's a pleasure to have you.
Hello, Chris. It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your book. It looks fantastic, and I'm very excited to talk to you tonight about it.
That's great. I'm excited to talk about it.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Tell us about the overall arc of what you're trying to talk about and what brought you to write Imperiled Life, Revolution Against Climate Catastrophe.
Right. So I think that the focus of the book is really summarized quite well in the title, Imperiled Life. And then the second part, Revolution Against Climate Catastrophe. And so my thesis really is that due to the climate change, the anthropogenic interference with the Earth's climate system, that capitalism, the Industrial Revolution, and the hegemonic forms that we are basically trapped in, that this interference is causing and threatens to cause life, or most complex forms of life, including, of course, humanity, to be imperiled, to be threatened with destruction and extinction. And so in Imperiled Life, I summarize a lot of the climatological evidence from many of the foremost scientists in this field, and reflect on the phenomenon of disaster and catastrophe historically. But I also present an alternative, and that is what I call revolution. And revolution not understood as the storming of the Winter Palace, as in October 1917, or Robespierre's, mass bloodshed in the French Revolution, but rather revolution, as Cornelius Castoriadis says, being the radical change of social institutions, of society. And this is the alternative that I am suggesting, and one that I think that we should be organizing toward and working toward as much as we can, possibly.
As you know, in the United States, we're living in probably one of the most reactionary media climates in terms of rejection of climate change, and a concerted effort by corporations to confuse the issue, just in the same way that tobacco companies confuse the issue of smoking and cancer. They're using this doubt. They're pushing the idea of doubt against the idea that this even exists. And I know that on this station and the audience that listens to KPFK, that it is a message that does not resonate. However, I think it's important for us to deal with the facts on the ground. So if you don't mind telling us where we're at in terms of the climate catastrophe, that would be important start for this discussion.
Of course. So this all has to do with the laws that are revealed through the study of chemistry and physics, which, underpin our reality, underpin our world, underpin medicine. So I think that basically this has to do with the release of carbon, with heat-trapping gases such as carbon dioxide, methane, greenhouse gas emissions that are being caused by the burning of carbon, of hydrocarbons, oil, gas, coal, that has really taken off since the Industrial Revolution, or since the rise of capitalism as an economic form, and it's spread throughout the world since that time. So really, what we see today is that average global temperatures have increased 0.8 degrees centigrade since the pre-industrial age, when the global carbon atmospheric concentration was estimated to be between 270 and 280 parts per million. Actually, a report that just came out, I think, 2 weeks ago or so, is suggesting that that level at the poles of the Earth now has reached 400. And this is far beyond levels that most climatologists, especially Jim Hansen with NASA, have suggested as being any sort of rational level, and that they really threaten catastrophe. So the most definitive report on this is the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's fourth annual report, which estimates that global average temperatures can be expected to increase between 1 and 6 degrees centigrade over the 21st century. But as many critical climatologists have said, looking at these figures, this seems to be a vast underestimate, given that the IPCC does not include consideration of the various positive feedback loops that climate change gives rise to, such as, for example, the melting of the Arctic ice or the glacial ice around the world, which, through the albedo effect, normally would reflect much of the solar radiation that comes in from the sun back out into space. But with the eradication of those white areas, that solar radiation is absorbed, and thus it sort of gives rise to further heating. We can see it also in the threat of vast methane releases from the Siberian Arctic area. It's estimated that vast quantities of this heat-trapping gas, which is one-to-one much more devastating than carbon dioxide, which is what is produced by burning of coal, gas, and oil,
positive feedback loops.
Sorry?
Yeah, these positive feedback loops.
Right. So that consideration of these positive feedback loops, the methane, the burning down of the Amazon rainforest, all of these things that are instituted that are happening, that could happen because of increased average global temperatures, could bring this total far beyond 6 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. Some climatologists that I look at in the book suggest that it might even be as bad as 12 degrees centigrade. And this corresponds to a level that, you know, Jim Hansen himself in his most recent book, Storms of My Grandchildren, warns as being what could be called the Venus effect or the Venus syndrome, whereby the Earth's climate increases so radically in temperature, so quickly, that in fact the atmosphere could give rise to a situation like that on Venus, the second planet, of course, in our solar system, where life simply cannot exist. And so that's the worst-case scenario. But many of the normal or expected scenarios are totally catastrophic as well. The 2 degree centigrade average global temperature level, which is sort of, according to the United Nations and the European Union, even the U.S. government, that is, according to them, a safe limit, that is 1.2 degrees centigrade above what we've reached so far. But this would, according to climatological evidence and looking back at the Earth's geological record, this would threaten to destroy the Andes glaciers in South America, and probably would cause the Greenland ice sheet to terminally go into decline, thus increasing the sea levels radically by many meters.
And reducing the albedo of the Earth itself.
Indeed, of course.
And so, you know, and the thing to point out here, I read constantly about this particular issue, and a lot of climatologists, in the view of the IPCC, it's often considered very conservative in
right.
what its recommendations are. And there's actually a lot of climatologists and scientists who say exactly what you've described, these positive feedback loops. We don't know when and how these loops, these effects could take place, and in fact, that the actual time for a response to all this change in CO2 concentrations could actually kind of go off course very quickly, and in fact, changes could happen much faster than people have predicted. So there's this sense that the IPCC is actually very conservative, and yet, even the recommendations of the IPCC as it exists now are being ignored by most nations. In fact, you spent a lot of time in your book talking about the failure of Cancun, the failure of Copenhagen, and what we are seeing is, in fact, what we need to understand, in fact, is a much more systemic critique itself of capitalism and industry. In fact, you say industry is symptomatic of something much bigger. So when people say, let's just reduce the effects of industry, what you're really saying is we need to understand the systemic cause of what industry does, which is itself capitalism.
Right.
So can you expand on that thought?
Of course. So the Industrial Revolution, I think Karl Polanyi, in his Great Transformation, puts it quite well, where he sort of looks at the origins of capitalism, the enclosure of the commons, the common areas, the common lands in England, and the forced urbanization of the rural peasantry, sort of forcing them to go into labor for the factory worker, the factory owners in London and other places. The rise of this economic system is the basis for industrialization, the industrialization that we have seen as giving rise to this problem of mass carbon emissions. I think that Min-Chi Lee, who is an economist at the University of Utah, puts it quite well in a chart that he has made, which sort of looks at carbon emissions next to GDP, gross domestic product, over the last three centuries. And we see really that the GDP curve and the carbon emissions curve go exponentially up together. And it's not a mistake. It's not a coincidence that this is the case. It's really, I think, the rise of this economic system based on private property, based on massive social inequality, based on massive social alienation and lack of participatory decision-making processes over production, consumption, distribution, that really is driving this problem.
Yeah, and I think I'd like you to focus on the philosophical underpinnings of capitalism itself, because really that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the critique of capitalism itself. We're dealing with the ability to understand that a system that is based on infinite growth is going to destroy this planet. In fact, we're talking about many species potentially going extinct. We're talking about of the 8 or so million species that are on the planet that are believed to exist, we only know a fraction of them. And the potential for us to actually, what's often called these days is the Anthropocene, the time in which humans have such a massive impact on the environment that we actually may see a mass extinction event. So what we're really dealing with here is a philosophy of economics, a philosophy of growth, uber alles. And so let's break that down so we understand that when, for example, and I want to bring this up because many groups like 350.org who've raised the consciousness of many people about this issue, they seem, in my opinion, to fail to analyze the underpinnings of capitalism itself and in fact, work very closely with state governments and governments in general in my opinion, put band-aids on a very systemic crisis. And I'd like to address the fundamental underlying issues of what it is that capitalism is capable of doing to our planet and the species.
Of course. Well, as I mentioned before, I mean, capitalism is based on private property rights, on the eradication of the common areas that historically in England and throughout much of the world, we think of human history, we think of human prehistory, we think of traditional societies, all of these sort of social forms that have been used to sort of mitigate greed, mitigate accumulation of wealth and things like this. Capitalism does away with all of those things, or marginalizes them as much as possible. So that's one thing. Another thing is that it institutes a ruling class that together with the state, with governments around the world, works to uphold the system. And, you know, to use violence, military violence, imperial violence, to squash any threat, really, to any threat of resistance to that rule. We see that in Noam Chomsky's posited mafia doctrine, whereby he sort of analyzes the United States in the 20th century in all of its attacks on Guatemala, on Nicaragua, on Vietnam, on Cuba, on various societies that have tried to institute relations, social relations, societies that are based on things other than accumulation of wealth without end, massive social inequality, and these types of things. So this whole philosophy is one that is promoted by privileged elites, those who, the minority, the 1% perhaps in the Occupy Wall Street imagery, that they sort of set up these social forums and they colonize the media, education, and all these things, so that they have repressive power on the one hand, the police and the military, but also try to control the minds, the ideologies, the philosophies, the thoughts of all of the subordinated people, so as to keep them tied into this system and try to prevent them from breaking away from it and instituting something more rational, something more humane, something less destructive. And yes, it's totally not a surprise that we see the sixth mass extinction event being created. You know, many biologists are looking at this problem. The 8.7 million species you cited earlier are really radically threatened by this problem of capitalism and capital-induced climate change, no doubt.
And I'd like you to address, I want to remind listeners first that I'm speaking to Javier Cethnas. He's a libertarian socialist educator and rights advocate. He has a new book. It's published by AK Press. It's called Imperil Life, Revolution Against Climate Catastrophe. It is the fourth installment in the Anarchist Intervention Series of the Institute for Anarchist Studies and AK Press. I want you to address this issue that some on the left have argued, including Christian Parenti in a recent book, that states will be essential to solving the climate crisis simply because of the size of the problem. In other words, individual action will be, while may not be totally ineffectual, it is not the source of where efforts should be focused. What is your response to that?
Well, I think it's definitely true. We've seen in environmentalism, and specifically with sort of hegemonic environmental groups, liberal environmentalism, when addressing this problem of climate change, stressing individual solutions such as reducing, you know, don't go flying to Tahiti for your vacation, or, you know, change your light bulb, things like this. So the individual solution, that seems very ineffectual, no doubt. I think that critiques of that position are definitely legitimate and justified. However, Christian Parenti, who, his Tropic of Chaos book is really an excellent book in general, but he only spends about two pages, the last two pages of the book, on analyzing this problem in political terms, in analyzing the systemic underpinnings of this problem. And he does, you're right, he does endorse the state, looking back, I guess, at the tradition, for example, of Roosevelt and the New Deal, or social democracy in Europe. Looking at sort of the regulatory role that the state can play in dealing with this problem. And I think that's an easy answer to make, but I don't think that it really, I mean, philosophically or practically, it's quite flawed. I mean, if we look just simply at Barack Obama's presidency in the United States, which is as quote-unquote progressive or humane as anyone has expected from the U.S. central government in the last 30 years, approximately. I mean, look, he has, you know, signed off on the building of the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, he's opened vast tracts of, I believe it's Wyoming, to coal mining. He has single-handedly dashed the hopes of sort of resolving or attempting to resolve this problem at the Copenhagen and Cancun climate summits. So I think that. Just empirically, if we look at, I mean, the state governments around the world, which are, as I've said before, beholden to maintaining this capitalist system, are radically failing to address this problem in any sort of way that would follow from the science, from the climatology, from the basic chemistry and physics of this problem. So I don't see really any reason to think that this same model, this same form, should be expected to address this in any sort of a rational way. I mean, that's what Albert Einstein defined as insanity.
Yeah.
So,
and I completely agree with that assessment. I wanted you to address it, but the fact is that states will be completely unresponsive to the initiatives by a people's movement to change the climate crisis, simply because the logic of the underlying system itself, capital accumulation, expansion of resources, control of resources, war for resources, is not going to change simply by us voting people into office. I mean, that's ridiculous, in my personal opinion. But I do have to ask you, do you really think that anything barring a total collapse of the economic or political system will result in systemic change? I mean, in other words, barring a revolutionary movement to end capitalism and its symptomatic industrial behavior will be enough to prevent mass extinction?
Well, I think that... I mean, many people who have dealt with this problem, and in fact, many of the people that I've been in conversation with since the book has come out during my book tour, many of the people I've talked with sort of seem to not exactly advocate or endorse this idea of collapse, but perhaps welcome it in a certain way. And I think that that's a mistake. I think that the mass human suffering and destruction that would follow from any sort of collapse situation whereby, you know, agriculture is radically disrupted and many things like this would happen. I mean, I think that that is not a humane alternative or choice. And so what I am trying, I think the point of the end of the book, the last chapter of the book, is to present a humane, rational, and conscious alternative to both state capitalist insanity, as well as this sort of primitivist endorsement of collapse as a way of getting rid of capital in the state, finally. And I think that revolution, you know, the mass movement from below, the commune of communes, mass mobilizations sort of following from many of the examples we've seen in history, particularly from European history, the Paris Commune, the Spanish anarchists in the 1930s, the mass general strike wave in Russia in 1905, you know, the participatory democratic involvement in the February Revolution of 1917 in Russia, the May 1968 movements throughout the world, and I think even now, in the last 2 years, the shattering, devastating popular interventions that we've seen throughout the world, from the Arab-majority countries mm-hmm. to Southern Europe and Western Europe, to even here in the core, in the Occupy Decolonize movement. I think that we see in these movements a potential that we can perhaps help to intensify and help to radicalize and help push forward toward dealing with this from below, from the people's perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think that that really, and that is the point of anarchism, and that is really the point of, I think, of my thesis, of the subtitle of the book, Revolution Against Climate Change.
In fact, you call it an ecological anarcho-communism, in which you borrow from Marx, from each according to ability, to each according to need. You borrow from Murray Bookchin, a libertarian municipalism, and you also borrow from movements of the past and present of participatory democracy.
Yes, totally. Well, I think that, yes, from each according to ability to each according to need. I think that this is a social form, a cultural form that we've seen many times in the past. We see it often today in many different cultures, Arab culture, in our family cultures, in our friend cultures. I think that that taken together with sort of the participatory democratic model endorsed by Murray Bookchin through libertarian municipalism, whereby I think we see it here in this country in the General Assemblies of the Occupy movement, or at least a model of that, whereby the people can intervene and have their say, have their voice be heard. I think this model of a counterpower or a dual power of a developing movement from below that opposes and confronts ultimately the irrationality and barbarity of capital in the state, I think that is the hope that we can have for averting this problem, as with so many others. And I'd also take from Murray Bookchin his idea of post-scarcity anarchism, which follows from Marx, as well as from many of the Frankfurt School theorists of Germany, the idea that the people, the subordinated, the proletariat, but not just the industrial proletariat, the people in general, that they can rise up through the anarcho-syndicalist model and take control of production and radically redirect it using conscious democratic processes toward instituting, a rational response to this problem, one that is actually dealing with the science and dealing with the reality of chemistry and physics.
I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Javier Cethnas, who is a libertarian socialist educator and rights advocate. His new book is called Imperiled Life, Revolution Against Climate Catastrophe. It's published by AK Press, and I encourage all of you to go out and get this book. It's amazing. Javier, we only have about a minute left, so I want to make sure that we get information to people about how they can contact you and where they can get the book.
Sure. Well, the book is available on AK Press, akpress.org. It's there on the front page. It's AK Press's latest release, so you'll find it right there. You can also contact me directly, I guess, by my email, which is just my name, javier.cepnes86@gmail.com. And I would greatly welcome any sort of commentary that anyone would have. I would love to continue these conversations with other people, as I have started, really, with the launch of the book and my book tour.
Are you planning on being in Los Angeles anytime soon to talk about your book?
It's possible later in the summer. I mean, I had one event in L.A. A week and a half ago at the People's Library, but I don't have any really definite plans at this point.
Okay. Well, let's just make sure that people can get that book. akpress.org, and your email is javier.sethness, that's S-E-T-H-N-E-S-S, at Gmail?
Javier.sethness86.
Oh, javier.sethness86 at?
Gmail.com.
At gmail.com. Any last thoughts, Javier?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that generally, if I could just summarize the book and my impetus for writing it, I think that we face a very grim situation with the climate crisis, with the environmental crisis in general, and we see this in the science. We see this in the climatology, in the biology, in the objective assessment of the world that has been destroyed and degraded by capitalism in the state. However, we also see a radical underpinning in history and in the present, one that that we see through mass mobilizations for rational and humane policies. And I think that that is the point. That is what we need to be working on. We need to be intensifying and organizing toward that end of putting an end to these barbaric forms, these destructive, alienating forms of the state and capital, toward realizing a liberated future free from the threat.
Javier, I got to cut you off there, but I want to thank you very much for joining me tonight on Indie Media on Air. It's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
All right. And please check out his book, Imperial Life, Revolution Against Climate Catastrophe, available at akpress.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Burnett, and we'll be back next week with Indie Media on Air.
You're tuned into KBFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 at Ridgecrest and China Lake, and we stream worldwide online at kbfk.org. Stay tuned now for KBFK's